Fubon, 2850 Southeast 82nd Avenue, and at Orchids of 82nd Community Space, 8118 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information about specific events, times, and location can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th at the Dismantle Change Build Center in Portland. Alex Vitale, director of the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project, is the author of The End of Policing. He'll be speaking on how to reconstruct police culture and behavior and describe alternatives that remove the police from dealing with drug addiction, houselessness, sex work, mental health crises, and more. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th, 6 p.m. at the Dismantle Change Build Center, 14 Northeast Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Sean Blackwell. Sean was hospitalized in 1996 for acute psychosis and then discovered it was, in fact, a spiritual emergence experience he was going through. Sean's the author of the book, Am I Bipolar or Waking Up? He's the facilitator of breathwork healing retreats for people diagnosed with bipolar disorder and psychosis. So welcome to Madness Radio, Sean Blackwell.
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you again. A few months ago, I was down at your retreat in Brazil as part of a conference I was going to, and I had the opportunity to myself experience one of your breathwork healing retreats firsthand. So we're going to be talking about that on the show today. And you have been bringing breathwork, which we're going to be talking about what that is, to people who are wanting to recover and work with healing their experiences. But maybe we could start out with you saying a little bit about how you got involved with this work, and you yourself were hospitalized. You yourself went through a psychotic experience.
1996, I'm on an intensive self-help weekend with the what's called the Landmark Forum, sort of related to this thing from EST training in the 1970s. And it was just a very intense experience. And there was a moment there where they asked us to meditate on our fears and something related to a scuba diving accident I had had just a few months earlier surfaced, and I just popped and all my senses got sharpened. And a few days later, I just came to the assumption that I was kind of dreaming the whole thing and I was on a mission. I wasn't really on a mission. I thought I died during the scuba diving accident and I was going to meet God and I was being tested by God. I was in my underwear in a hotel ballroom and the police came to get me because I refused to put my clothes back on because God wanted me to arrive in heaven or nirvana or wherever in my purest form.
So this was triggered by the kind of emotional stress of the workshop that you were doing? You said it was really intense.
Well, it was kind of a perfect storm of things. There was a lot of triggers around the whole event. I had just changed cities. I was just changing jobs. I had had some trauma come up from the scuba diving accident where I lost my weight belt at about 90 feet below sea level, so I could have died. And then this Landmark Forum event, it was like 150 people all in a fairly small room being challenged about their own egos and how we're causing our own issues and causing our own dramas in our lives, basically pointing the finger at us and saying we're the biggest part of the problem in our own lives.
Strong. They're really pushing you to the breaking point, and you, it sounds like you broke in a really spectacular way. You went into a big altered state that would be called mania or psychosis, that would be seen as a symptom of bipolar disorder and a mental illness, right?
in the first few days, it led to things like me not really sleeping very much and starting to write all kinds of texts. Some of it was just wild stuff, other stuff related to issues in my own family, things like that. But then it just sort of launched off into, oh, I get it. I understand everything now. I must be dead. And once that delusion took hold, then things started to get a little bit.
At the time, it must have been really terrifying, and you ended up, you were hospitalized for a few days, yeah?
Yeah, and I would say that I went through an ego death of a not this sort of, oh, my ego has died and I'm this enlightened being now. Just a kind of an ego collapse that leads to an opening and broadening of your ego.
But really disorganized, like you were acting really weird. You weren't able to kind of do your ordinary responsibilities in the world.
And you function.
And you got the attention of the police, because taking your clothes off in the middle of a ballroom and refusing to put them back on is gonna alert the psychiatrists and the doctors for sure.
Yeah, and I pissed on the rug there, and I was rolling around in my own urine. It was just like, it was pretty full on.
So you're breaking the social conventions, but when people would say, "Hey, Sean, you're having an altered state. You're really kind of doing something really extreme." You had no self-awareness at all. Is that right?
Well, they wouldn't really say that to you, because when you go into that state, everybody around you sort of gets scared, and they don't really reach out and communicate with you in a genuine way.
Yeah, that's a big observation you make, because it's not just the individual that goes into this different sort of moment or this different state. It's actually all the people around them too. Often for them, it's the fear and the paralysis and the, oh my God, how do we not make it worse? Or what should we do? Or we're scared of this person, and then it just sort of feeds into itself.
Yeah, and I mean, if someone like you or Michael Cornwall, for example, had been with me and been able to relate to me and got a blanket around me and just gave me some space, I might not have needed to be hospitalized at all. They were nice about it. They actually seemed like they had been trained for this sort of situation. And they said to me, they said, "Sean, we don't really want to hurt you, man, but you got to come with us." And then they grabbed me and put me on the carpet. I actually got a carpet burn on my shoulder. They were pretty rough, because I was in pretty good shape at the time. So I was a handful, you know, even for two police officers.
You were kind of resisting. You were saying, "No, I don't want to go. I want to."
Yeah. And then they got, because I didn't know, one grabbed one hand, one grabbed the other. They got me on the floor, handcuffed me, and then got me in the hospital in the ambulance. And I still thought I was going to, I'll say heaven for lack of a better word, but I didn't really know what was going on. But I thought I was being transported to another dimension.
Which in the sense you were, because the psychiatric system is definitely a different dimension of reality, you could say.
Well, I think what saved me in a sense was I didn't know what was going on, but after 24 hours of sleep, I was like, I don't know what's going on, but I know I need to get out of here. And so then I just started telling them what I thought they wanted to hear, which was, "My name is Sean Blackwell. I'm in Toronto. These are my family members. And I think I'm better now. I told them I thought I had a post-traumatic stress disorder from the scuba diving accident, because I thought that would impress them. If I could diagnose myself, I thought they would be impressed by that." But then I went home and...
So it sounds like the sleep deprivation was a key element to what kind of broke you through to this state.
I'm sure it was part of it. I'm sure it was part of it.
And then getting some sleep brought you down out of it to some degree.
Yeah, I think so.
And then what happened when you went home?
I was pretty vulnerable, and I didn't talk to too many people for quite a while. But after a few weeks, an ex-girlfriend's friend of mine, she was from India, she was a past life therapist, and she came to visit me. And she was like, "Sean, as soon as I heard about what happened to you, I knew what it was." Because for me, I was just talking about spiritual things and peace and love and all this stuff. And she, from her background, she sort of identified with me having a sort of a waking experience. And so in talking to her, it gave me some validation.
So she was familiar with Eastern religion and reincarnation and spirituality and yoga, this kind of thing.
And that helped. That helped provide a context. The first book she gave me was, I think, Autobiography of a Yogi by
Paramahansa Yogananda. And so she really kind of guided you to having a different framework. Were you questioning your sanity before that? Were you saying, "Oh no, maybe I have a mental disorder. Did they give you medication in the hospital? What were they recommending to you? Or what was their understanding? And then how did you get this different understanding?"
Well, I had been studying a little bit about Buddhism previously for a couple of years, and my experience in the non-ordinary state was so overwhelmingly positive. I was a person who always felt like I didn't know enough. Finally, I felt like I had everything that I needed to know. I had insight into my family. All my senses had sharpened. And there was some fear that came up that, ironically, the self-help course had sort of helped me get in touch with, and then I could get in touch with that fear and express it. So it was so overwhelmingly positive that when the psychiatrist started talking to my family about a mental illness, I just thought they were idiots, and I blocked it all out. So I didn't go through the process of internalizing the stigma of mental illness the way pretty much 99% of people who get hospitalized do. And I think that was the great blessing of my experience, that I could get out of there relatively unharmed, you know?
Yeah, because my experience was so dark, on the other hand. It was so negative. There was so much suffering and pain and fear around it that I desperately wanted to believe that I had schizophrenia or a mental illness, or, you know, and that the medications were helping me, because I was in so much pain. I was looking for a way out. So that was the solution. But you came at it from a different kind of angle. But were you, even though you didn't see yourself as having a mental illness, were you able to go back to work or kind of return to your sort of ordinary responsibilities in life? Or
I was in a very lucky place, because I had actually just moved back to Toronto from Vancouver to apply for a job interview. So I had like my first job interview with this particular company just a day or two before my episode. And then as things turned out, I would just go and work part-time for this guy like for maybe a few days every couple of months. And so I had about 4 months there where I could just stay home and integrate, and then just go out once in a while and do a bit of work. And that's exactly what I needed. And I returned to work full-time about 5 months later, and nobody knew anything. Like, I was able to keep it completely under wraps.
You know? So it was kind of a perfect storm that led you into the crisis, but also you had a kind of a positive perfect storm. You had really good supportive elements in place that helped you make it through it, it sounds like.
Right. And my parents, you know, my parents are 50, like I'm 53. So my parents were like growing up in the 1950s. So they had a healthy distrust of psychiatrists from back then. You know, that generation, they don't trust the shrinks, right? So they didn't have much of an interest in me seeing those doctors unless I wanted to go. So I didn't get any family pressure either. You know, so that was really helpful. They were quite supportive, even though they didn't know what I was going through.
So you went back to your work, to your career. It's interesting, you and I both have sounds like you were a lot more extensively involved in advertising in that world. But I did actually spend about 6 months in Portland working for Wieden and Kennedy, a big advertising agency there. So we have that as one of many things that we have in common, actually. And then what happened? So you continued to work in your life, and then how did that go?
Well, I actually got into a job in advertising after my crisis that I've been trying to get into for 4 years, finally landed that sort of big job opportunity that I've been looking for. And then even though I was looking for a way out, I became really successful in the job in a way that I'd never been before. My salary tripled over the next 3 years.
Do you think that the success in the job was maybe it was contributed to by these positive things that had happened to you after this crisis break that you had?
Yeah, absolutely. Because before that, I was sort of guarded. I didn't connect with people particularly well. And I was always worrying about how I was going to get my job done. And I didn't realize I was like that, but I was like that. And then when I had my crisis and I went back, I was much more easy. It was much easier for me to connect with people. And people felt that I really cared about their business. And things went really well. Even though I really wasn't into advertising anymore, things went much more smoothly and I was much more successful. And it was directly related to this, what I came to call a spiritual emergency, which was Stan Grof's term.
So this thing that happened to you, this crisis or this break, which would have been seen as an illness and impairment and a limitation, actually helped your life.
It was the most important thing that has ever happened to me personally, in my opinion.
Do you want to just say a little bit more about what actually a breathwork session involves? You mentioned the music and the group. But let's paint more of a picture for people of what actually it looks like.
There'll be a group of people in a room. We'll say we'll talk about 12 people for the sake of argument, okay? Six of those people will be the breathers, and then six of those people will be sitters. They will sit and support the breather empathetically. So people will be sort of taken into pairs, okay? And then you'll have these facilitators who are trained professionals through a Groff transpersonal training, who have learned how to relate to people when the holotropic experiences become more powerful or extreme, you might say. So you'll have six people laying down, lights will be dimmed, people will put masks on, they'll lay on yoga mats, they'll start a kind of a relaxation exercise to relax their entire body, and they'll be encouraged to start breathing more aggressively. You know, nothing really planned, you can breathe in your own way. The way I would breathe might sound more like almost like a jogging or an exercise breath, but comfortable. And then the music that's played, especially in the first hour, tends to be quite aggressive. A lot of hard tribal drumming, some electronic music, things to get you really activated and energized. And I would describe it as more of an aggressive masculine energy to sort of take you into that territory.
And so if anybody's gone to a big concert where there's lots of dancing and it's really intense and really loud music, you can kind of feel a sense of that. You start to lose yourself. You sort of go into this altered state, mild, just from being in this intense sensory overload kind of environment. So when we talk about, you know, going beyond the ego or going into the altered state, it sounds like this sort of weird, rarefied thing, but actually we're kind of already familiar with going into altered states because it happens to us when we listen to music, or if we go into a trance when we're driving, or certainly when we drink alcohol or smoke cannabis, or we're dancing for a long period of time, or maybe we're hiking, or we have sleep deprivation. So in breath work, we're working with a similar kind of capacity, the innate capacity that the psyche of all humans has to go into these altered states, which are stepping outside of your ordinary identity and stepping outside of your ordinary sense of yourself. And in the breath work, it's very concentrated, focused, and harnessed for a very specific purpose.
Yeah, and you know, I used to belong to a shamanic group, and we would do these shamanic dances where we would go like for 3 days with no food and no water, you know. And I was talking to my shaman friend that used to lead these dances, and I told her, I'd say, you know how we'd be doing all this dancing and then we'd sort of hit the pole and go into a non-ordinary state and be carried back to our birth? And she'd say, yeah. I'd say, well, when you do holotropic breath work, you get there in about 5 minutes. And she cracked up laughing because in the shamanic dances, you're just sort of suffering and you're starving and you're sweaty and you're hot and you're exhausted. And then, boom, you get transported into this, you know, non-ordinary state. And then with breath work, it's like, well, you're there in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's extraordinarily powerful. And, you know, you mentioned before the idea of set and setting. And we know from research, going back to what I said about the placebo effect, just the expectation of healing is itself very powerful. So in the world of psychedelic medicine, even the people who are doing the laboratory research about psychedelic to develop new psychedelic pharmaceuticals, they recognize the central importance of set and setting. And until you've actually been through it, you're of course quite skeptical, because all you're doing is lying there and breathing in a really intense way, listening to really powerful music. And you might think, well, you know, nothing's going to happen. What can happen? Well, actually, a lot happens. And one of the things that I think is powerful about breath work is that even though you are going in this journey where you give up control because you go into this altered state, you have much more control in the sense that you can open your eyes, take the mask off, and you could turn the music off and you could kind of interrupt it. And that creates a certain degree of safety that psychedelic drugs don't have, or going off into the wilderness for 3 days for a really intense vision quest doesn't have. And people are very skeptical. They say, well, you know, psychedelics, ayahuasca, I mean, yeah, that's causing this chemical thing in my brain, but how could just breathing do something as powerful? And the answer is yes, it can do something as powerful.
Well, I think the big mistake people make with psychedelics is that they think that the healing agent is in the chemical itself. And I don't believe it is. I think that the chemical agent is causing a breakdown of the ego, particularly with the psychedelics. It's causing a breakdown of the ego by chemical means, which is opening you up to the inner healer. Like when people have healing experiences on ayahuasca, it's still this divine intelligence that's working through you. It's not necessarily the plant.
I would tend to agree with that. I would just add that, especially with ayahuasca, there's a continuity with the indigenous traditions, because in an ayahuasca ceremony, there's often people who have been to the Amazon and who are bringing that those songs forward, and they have that connection, and there's an evocation and a continuity with an existing indigenous tradition that maybe magnifies and amplifies this inner capacity that I think that you're pointing to, and I think correctly, that we all have. And of course, all these things are extremely mysterious, but we should say, to kind of pick up where you were talking about the description of painting a picture for people, that, you know, you start breathing and the music is loud, and then tell us what happens to people at that point.
Well, the breathing is a little bit like, imagine you're a surfer and you want to go surf waves. Well, before you're surfing, you have to swim out to meet those waves. So the breathing is like swimming out into the ocean of your unconscious, and then these waves of unconscious material will start to surface. And when they come, you don't need to really worry about the breathing. What's more important is your own self-expression, which is through the physical movement and the vocalizing. You're going to be moving around on the mat to sort of express what's happening in your psyche.
In a sense, it's a form of very deep listening. You're going into a very, very deep listening to parts of yourself that you maybe haven't listened to because you haven't had the space or the opportunity or the invitation to do that.
What you're describing as the unconscious is what most people think of the unconscious, but it does get freakier. So like this weekend, there was a guy there and he turned into a gorilla. And so he was on the mat making like sort of intimidating gestures with his teeth, making gorilla noises, sort of moving around the mat like a gorilla. And so we needed to sort of keep him in a protected space, because as long as he's on his yoga mat acting like a gorilla, that's fine. But if he starts to run around the room and jump on other breathers like a gorilla, that's a real problem. So that's why you need these trained facilitators there.
So when you say unconscious material, there's something going on there. He's not just acting freaky, but there may be a part of himself that needs to be in touch with the strength or the primal spontaneity or the rawness or the animal quality. Or maybe the gorilla is a symbol that he's picked up, that he has some meaningful association with it. And then by playing it out in this theatrical expression, he's moving something in his deeper psyche that maybe was stuck,
as you were saying before.
And then it somehow, because I think that from the outside, what we're describing is so experiential. It's like trying to describe someone what going to a concert is if they've never heard music. I mean, you don't really understand it unless you've kind of been through it. So he turns into a gorilla, in a sense. He acts like a gorilla. How is that helpful for him, or was it helpful for him? Why might that be helpful for someone to do this freaky, weird thing?
Oh, well, I think it can be very helpful for a person because it's exactly how you just described it, Will. You know, you can think of it in the simplest terms as an archetypal kind of energy that has been repressed in you. It's not really part of your daily psyche. It's a repressed part of your unconscious, and now it's coming into you. So now you have more of an authentic, positive, masculine presence, whereas maybe in the past, for example, that gorilla energy, assuming that it was a masculine force, if that masculine force is repressed and isn't part of your daily psyche, it might come out in negative ways. It might cause you drama. Maybe it leads you to lash out in violence some ways that you're not, that you really shouldn't be, or even be passive aggressive in ways that are causing difficulties in your life, you know. So once that's integrated, it becomes positive and natural.
So it's a way of getting in touch with ourselves and being more who we are fully.
Yeah, and just to tie in this experience of the guy who became the gorilla on the weekend, when I was in the hospital, I went into a kind of spontaneous regression. And at one point, I felt like I was at the beginning of time, and I started making ape noises in the psychiatric hospital. So imagine, I'm in my underwear, I'm covered in pee, I'm chained to a hospital bed, and I'm starting to like, you know, here comes the medication, right? I mean, they don't need to interview you after you make ape noises. But that's exactly what this guy was doing on the weekend. And we've just got this nice little therapeutic container for him. and beautiful. You can just go wild for 3 hours.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if psychiatric hospitals were actually places to express ourselves and to be listened to and held safely, rather than as soon as you get loud or weird, you get contained and suppressed with medication and seen as more of a symptom. Obviously, you're delusional, but actually it could be a positive healing process that you're going through, getting in touch with this deeper part of your emotional self. Breathwork is kind of a controlled, safe way of going crazy.
Yeah, I think so.
And this was part of the genius of Lange's work, was that he was trying to create spaces for people to go crazy with Kingsley Hall. And you could say in society, we sort of need people to go a little bit more crazy, because especially with the climate emergency that we're facing and so many social challenges, I think that could be really beneficial. Going a little bit crazy, but doing it in a more controlled, healing, safe way.
That's sort of what I see as my life mission. It's like somehow I've got to get this work into psychiatric hospitals eventually.
Sean, give us some more examples from your own experience with holotropic breathworks. What are some of the things that you've been through, and how has it been helpful for you?
Okay, well, I've had a number of sessions, and a lot of them included animal experiences. You know, I've been a dog, I've been a salamander, or, you know, these kind of things. But one aspect that's really unique to Groff's work, which is very important, is birth regressions. So yeah, I worked with them for a couple of sessions, and then in the third session that I was with them, my whole birth process started, and there was this amazing enthusiasm I had for coming out that birth canal. I felt like I was really ready to face life. But then as I was born, you know, according to the Groff work, there should be a sense with a healthy birth, a sense of victory, a sense of earning something, an accomplishment, and maybe confusion, because you're sort of out into the world for the first time. But in my case, the first words out of my mouth at my birth was, it was like I didn't even have a mother. And I started crying. And it was a very sad moment for me, because it seems like I was one of those 1960s babies that just got wrapped up and taken to a nursery with very little human contact, especially with my mother. And so all of a sudden, the lights went on, that this lack of success I had felt in my life was actually rooted in my birth process.
And then when the lights went on, did you notice that you felt more successful after that? I mean, did it actually create a change emotionally, psychologically for you after that?
Absolutely. And actually, it came in another session where I had the sense of taking my arms off, because they represented, you know, two women in my life, my wife and my partner, my co-partner in this work in Germany. And I took them away and I just sat there alone. And then I saw a light above me, a pink light. And I reached up for that light and I pulled it down into me, you know, sitting just in my underwear in the breathwork facility. I was alone in the breathwork facility and they let me take my clothes off. Pulled that light into my heart and then really felt this sense of success. Well, I'm kind of emotional when I think about it, because it was a feeling of success that I never had before, and it came to me in the breathwork process. And then after that, things felt much easier. I've been much more at ease with my life. I'm not nearly as feeling like I'm not doing enough, which is what I felt before. And I'm taking life much more like as it comes.
I am noticing the time. We're going to need to start to wrap up. So remind us the name of your book and your YouTube channel, how people can get in touch with you.
Okay, the best way to get in touch with me is through my website, bipolarawakenings.com. And there you can access my book. You've got access to my videos as well as information on the healing retreat.
Of course, a lot of people may be interested in breathwork. They can get in touch with you. There are breathwork communities worldwide. That's holotropic breathwork, also different approaches like shamanic breathwork. I'm thinking of the work of Nita Gage, for example, also Linda Starwolf. And I would very strongly recommend that you be very cautious. Don't just find somebody on the internet. Go through friendship networks and get personal referrals so you can find somebody who has integrity, who has a personal recommendation. Ask lots of questions, be very cautious, and also keep in mind that some of the people in that community do have a professional stance and may have a pathologizing approach, and do what you can from a harm reduction perspective. Money is, of course, also a concern, and any practitioner that has integrity will have sliding scale and scholarship opportunities in their work. Sean Blackwell, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. And I really appreciate your transparency in sharing everything that went on between us. It was a very memorable time we had together.
You've been listening to an interview with Sean Blackwell. Sean was hospitalized in 1996 for acute psychosis that he discovered was in fact a spiritual experience. Author of the book, Am I Bipolar or Waking Up? And the YouTube channel, Bipolar or Waking Up? Sean is the facilitator of breathwork healing retreats for people diagnosed with bipolar disorder and psychosis. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in.
And it is 10:30 a.m. on your community radio, KBOO Portland. Well, now it's 10:30 a.m. on your community radio, KBOO Portland. And it's time for me to remind you about getting involved in your community radio. Some members of our community got involved in one particular way, and I'm going to tell you about it right now, because KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema, open every night and featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.